Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, February 7th, 2008. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, home brewer Anthony Fisher joins us to talk about advanced yeast handling techniques. So you want to step up your yeast culturing to that of a laboratory level? Well, Anthony will give us a peek into what's entailed in culturing and storing yeasts like the pros. Well, if you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. Well, before I get started, there's yet another podcasting milestone I want to mention. The Big Foamy Head guys have sailed through the 100th episode mark. Of course, they did it by producing around 20 episodes a week for the past 2 weeks, but still, it counts. Just teasing, guys. Congratulations. We're up to around 131, for those of you who are keeping score at home. My first car was a Fiat 131. Coincidence? I don't know. Let's look into the mailbag. If you'll remember last week, James from Tullahoma, Tennessee, wrote in asking if his grandmother's copper kettle would be good to brew in. Well, Andy, Steve, and I assumed the answer was yes, since copper's been used for centuries in brewing. Well, Mike from Dallas wrote in saying the brewer with the copper kettle should inspect for verdigris, as this is toxic. It can be removed per John Palmer's How to Brew section on cleaning metals. Well, I looked in How to Brew, and on page 310, sure enough, John mentions verdigris, and it's a toxic blue-green oxide. And you can Google verdigris to see what it looks like. John says to clean heavy oxidation, which is black, and verdigris, use vinegar or oxalic acid-based cleansers like Revere Copper and Stainless Steel Cleaner. So there you go, another reason to own a copy of How to Brew. If your copper kettle is the color of the Statue of Liberty, just be sure to clean it well before you use it to brew in. Appreciate the catch, Mike, and I've forwarded the info to James. Mark from Evanston, Illinois writes, I've noticed that with plain tap water, my hydrometer is reading 1.002 at 65 degrees Fahrenheit. Basically, it's reading 0.002 high. My guess is that the paper scale inside shifted slightly. So my question is, does that 0.002 stay consistent as I'm reading higher density liquids? For example, can I just subtract 0.002 to all my readings? My hunch is that it should be consistent. Well, you're right on track, Mark. If your hydrometer is indeed 0.002 off, then subtracting 0.002 from your future measurements should do the trick. But first, find out what the calibration temperature of your hydrometer is. It should be in the instructions that came with it. Mine's at 60 degrees Fahrenheit. If you measure the gravity of distilled water at that calibration temperature, you'll see for sure, if your hydrometer is off. Well, Bob, who's a senior at State University of New York at Geneseo, writes, my question in regard to sanitation arises from one of your video podcasts in which you dry hopped and racked your six-pack IPA. From everything I've read, both handling the hops by hand, those which are going directly contact the fermenting beer, and plugging off the siphoned beer with your thumb, would seem like an automatic invitation to contamination. Please let me know if I'm being overcautious by never contacting the beer or equipment which will directly contact it by hand, or clean hand contact, or if clean hand contact is okay in small amounts, which would save me from much concern and some of my brew day acrobatics. Well, Bob, it depends on who you ask, I guess. Of course, I have corresponded with a brewer or two who has called me, like you did, on my thumb on the end of the siphon hose method. And one brewer actually uses sterile gloves when he handles the beer or his equipment. As you can see on the video, I don't go that far. But what you may not see is that there is a sink full of iodophore solution behind me in the kitchen. And I'm pretty cautious about dipping my hands in the sanitizing solution as I'm working around the beer and gear. Now, as far as the hops are concerned, I've been told that dry hopping is safe in that you don't have to sanitize or pasteurize the hops when they go into the secondary fermenter. And it helps that at that point the beer has alcohol present, too, in the secondary, so that will help ward off infection a bit. So my advice is keep sanitizer handy in the kitchen, in the sink or in a bowl or a wallpaper tray, which is good for sanitizing racking wands in and such. Dip your hands in every now and then, especially after, you know, scratching your nose or petting the dog, and you should be okay. I mean, you've seen what I do, and my beers aren't rampant with infection, so I guess I'm doing something right. Douglas from Salt Lake City writes, I would like your thoughts on handling hops after you've moved the chilled wort from the brew kettle to the primary fermenter. I own a metal strainer that I sanitize, and it expands to cover the opening of my plastic bucket primary. Instead of racking from the kettle to the primary, I simply pour from the kettle through the strainer into the primary. I'm left with a pile of hop pellet remains in the strainer, and I'm always tempted to press on the hops with a mash paddle to get every drop of goodness from the saturated hops. Douglas says, when I used to steep grains in a grain bag during malt extract brews, I'd been told you don't want to squeeze the grain bag after you remove it to avoid off flavors. I wonder if there are any similar risks with wringing out hop remains, or if it doesn't hurt and might help get more flavor from the hops. Well, I believe you don't squeeze the grain bag because you don't want to get some of the astringency that may come from the husks. So don't squeeze the grain bag. At least that's what I've heard. As far as squeezing the hops, I have a little story to tell. After we turned off the mics at the end of the Partygile brewing session that you heard on a recent episode, Andy was having trouble getting the last bit of wort out of the brew pot. All those whole hops were getting in the way of the siphon and hanging on to a lot of wort, as they tend to do. So what we did was to sanitize a grain bag and pour the wort through it until it was full of hops. Then we closed the top and wrung out as much wort as we could. And we did this two or three times, and I was amazed at how much wort came out of those hop sponges. Now, Andy may get mad at me for telling this story because it's probably not the best brewing practice to play around this much in the chilled wort. But I have to say that the barley wine is delicious. And I'm glad that we squeezed every last drop we could from those hop sponges. And one last note, after you've squeezed the hop juice or the wort out of a big glop of hops, not the prettiest thing in the sink. Okay, let's get on with our interview for this week. Anthony Fisher is a student at the University of Missouri at St. Louis. As a part of his work at the university, he handles yeast for research purposes. So I asked him on the show to let us in on some of the advanced techniques that he has for storing and culturing yeast. And Steve Wilkes joined me in the studio. Anthony Fisher, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for having me, James.
And here in the studio joining me to help me come up with intelligent-sounding questions is Steve Wilkes.
Thanks, James. I'm not sure how intelligent they'll be, but they'll certainly be questions.
And we're here to talk about advanced yeast handling. And Anthony, you are you were up at the University of Missouri at St. Louis, and you handle yeast all the time, right?
Every day.
What kind of things do you do up there?
My lab is researching a particular set of proteins that are involved in regulating molecules called RNA, which then are turned into protein and proteins, as we know, enable the cell to do many different functions, such as digest sugar into alcohol, that being the most notable function I can think of. But as far as yeast handling is concerned, we have several different solid and liquid medias going at any given particular time. So I would say I have a pretty thorough understanding of growing yeast.
And so homebrewing is no big deal for you as far as technicality.
The growing the yeast part is no big deal for me.
Well, let's get started. And I guess the first thing that we've got to think about when we're really talking about handling the yeast and getting it ready for long-term storage and propagation and all that, usually we say in homebrewing that you have to be sanitary and not necessarily sterile, but in this case, being sterile and having your equipment sterilized is important, right?
In home brewing, when we sanitize things, you know, if you look on any bottle of store-bought sanitizer, most commonly you'll find a phrase that says kills 99.9% of bacteria. Well, they can't say they kill 100% because there are always some bacteria that have, and I'm speaking bacteria, but I'm also including here other contaminants, molds, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. We cannot effectively kill, usually by chemical means, every single bacteria. Some have defenses against certain sanitizers and so on and so forth. And if any one of those contaminants gets into home brew, normally if it's a small contamination, you know, it's been said on this show before that the yeast will outcompete those other organisms for the nutrients, i.e. the sugar and other vitamins in brew, and that's true. However, when we're talking about propagating yeast so as to maintain a pure culture, sterilization is very important as to making sure that contaminants stay out, because there are several bacteria that form colonies that look a lot like yeast. Mm. And if you're not careful, one of them could end up in your brews.
So we're talking about killing the live bacteria and killing the spores as well. I mean, just completely everything is dead.
Correct.
So how do we do that? How do you do it in the lab, and how can we do it at home?
Well, in the lab, we have a very, very large, very heavy autoclave, which is essentially a machine that that increases the temperature to about 121 degrees Celsius, which I did the calculations, and I'm trying to remember the number of what that is in Fahrenheit. I believe it's around 250, and increases the pressure, I believe, to 15 pounds per square inch. And it is the combined effect of that high pressure and that high temperature that ensures not only live bacteria, but also the spores that you mentioned, which are the bacteria will enclose itself in a structure and is very resistant to heat and other kind of environmental stresses in this form. And this method of sterilizing ensures that all of those are essentially dead, cannot propagate at all.
Not all of us have an autoclave at home.
Well, I do. I have a Model 85-9000 from Acme.
So do I. I love it.
It's great.
I didn't like the colors of this year's model, so
yeah,
I'm waiting.
Well. So if you don't have a Model 85-9000, what do you do?
An autoclave shares a lot of the same properties. You said a lot of people don't have an autoclave in their home, but a lot of people do have a pressure cooker in their home.
Huh.
And that is essentially the same, working on the same principles. The way that the temperature of the water, which is what autoclaves and pressure cookers use to cook, is some water-based liquid, is they keep the volume of the container constant, and relating to the ideal gas law, which I don't want to go over now because I don't remember, but basically it allows the water to be heated at above boiling temperatures. And this is the same theory behind a pressure cooker. You can cook foods in shorter amount of times because the water is allowed to come up to a higher temperature. I did a little looking around on the internet, and there are some very affordable, I would say, probably autoclave quality pressure cookers. And they would usually go for, and I'm quoting a couple of prices I saw, between $200 and $400.
So you've got to be kind of serious about yeast handling, or you can also go into canning as well.
And well, there you go.
Yeah. So a dual purpose for your home autoclave there with your pressure cooker. So what other equipment are we looking at when we're looking at advanced yeast handling?
You're going to need a couple of things to actually handle the yeast themselves, as well as a couple of ingredients, which you can probably pick up from your local homebrew shop, to make the media to grow the yeast cells on that you wish. As far as handling the yeast, you're going to need some sort of heat source. A Bunsen burner is recommended, but I don't have a gas line that I can hook up to a Bunsen burner. So what I use, and it's perfectly fine, is an alcohol lamp. And for those of our listeners who don't know, an alcohol lamp is basically like a container with a wick inside of it. And a little portion that sticks out, and you light it, and it burns the ethanol from the inside, and it creates a flame. And that's the other kind of miniature way to sterilize something, is to heat it to super hot temperatures. If we think that paper burns at 451 degrees Fahrenheit, we can assume that that alcohol lamp gets up to at least those temperatures. Mm-hmm. And the other instrument. It's what's called either an inoculating loop or an inoculating needle. And again, that depends on basically the configuration of the media that you wish to grow yeast on. And I'll go into that a little bit later. But, an inoculating loop and needle are just, thin pieces of wire that are attached to a larger piece of metal that you will hold over the flame until they get red hot and sterilize it, and then kind of let it cool off, because we don't want to be killing off the yeast with our super hot inoculating loop. And at that point,
wait till it's not red anymore.
Right. And at that point, that inoculating loop or needle is considered sterile and is readily available to transfer cultures. The other thing that you need is basically compartments to hold this solid media that you'll be growing your yeast cells on, or liquid if you choose to go that route. I would say probably the most notably the two at the forefront are either culture dishes, or sometimes called petri dishes, or test tubes. And in addition, you also need something called agar, which is it's derived from some sort of seed, I believe. And it basically when put in some sort of liquid, heat it up until the agar completely dissolves and then let cool, it forms a solid mass upon which then microorganisms can grow.
Now, where do you where's a good source to get the agar and the petri dishes and such as that? Are there, other than, I guess there are online laboratory supply shops and things like that, but right. Are those typically found around town?
I picked up all of the equipment that I'm using at my local homebrew shop.
Wow.
They supplied the agar. They supplied the glass petri dish. I prefer using a glass petri dish because it can be reused, as opposed to sometimes they'll sell plastic petri dishes in about 20 of them pre-sterilized in a long sleeve. They had the inoculating loop, and they had a couple of pre-sterilized miniature pipettes. They even sell a kit, a complete yeast culturing kit.
Wow.
Of which I'm sure you could find something on the internet that would sell something like that, if not in a homebrew shop, some other type of shop available to the average consumer.
So once we have our equipment, how do we go about it? Where do you get your yeast cultures from, and what do you do with them once you've got them?
I get them from basically anywhere I can, from the bottom of bottle conditioned beers, usually I'll get them from a White Labs or a Y Yeast tube or packet. So I can take you through just usually what I do. I prepare on my glass petri dish a solution of water, a little bit of agar, which I then I do have an autoclave at home, and it gets up to 250 degrees Fahrenheit. Sterilize that, and at that point the agar is sufficiently melted and dissolved into the liquid, and then I bring it out and I put in a little dry malt extract, a tiny pinch of brewer's yeast nutrient, and generally the method to pour to pouring this still liquid agar mixture into a plate is wait until it is hot, but not hot enough for you to, you know, immediately drop. Is it cool to the touch, but still liquid form? Pour it in the plate, quickly cover the plate, and let it solidify. And then you have your plate. And usually I'll do this all on my brew day. I will I usually use Y yeast. I'll smack the pack, wait until it comes up, and then immediately after I cut open the pack, I will pass my inoculating loop over the flame, stick it in just to grab a little bit of the cells, kind of spread them out on the plate, and then cover the plate and set it aside, and then continue on with my brew day.
Huh. So you're able to kind of make the most out of your purchase there. Is that the biggest advantage to culturing the yeast in this way?
Well, I would say after you get going, I imagine it would be a lot like deciding to go into home brewing for the first time. The setup initially may be a bit expensive, but after you brew enough home brew, and especially if you grow your own hops, and even if you malt your own barley, the cost factor as far as buying good beer in the store I spend less on homebrewing supplies than I would spend at the store for beer. So I would say, and this is being a bit biased because I am a poor college student, this does allow me to save a bit of money when the packs are going off at $8 or $9 a piece.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be getting our yeast from these labs, because they are good and they are extremely pure cultures from several different. I know in an episode or in an issue rather of BYO magazine, they listed the sources of several different of their yeast strains, and so they are the go-to people for the pure yeast strains.
Those of us who have reused yeast and not gone to this stringent of, you know, care and recycling the yeast. Mm-hmm. You know, I was asked by a friend of mine, you know, why do you go to the trouble when, you know, yeast is not that expensive? And my response was, well, it's another step to do. It's fun for me to do this, to the challenge of seeing how long I can stretch, you know, one packet of or tube of yeast. So there's also that to enter into the equation as well. So you can use your method to either, if you find an interesting strain of yeast in a fun beer that you like, you can take that out of the dregs, and you can also make your dollar go further by harvesting the commercial yeast that you buy at the homebrew store.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it is exactly like you said. It's just another... another facet in the homebrewing scene. I mean, I think homebrewers by nature are tinkerers. I know I am.
Once you get your yeast on the petri dish, mm-hmm. How long will it sit there? What do you do with it after that?
We brew. If you take your typical ale yeast, I would say typical fermentation temperature right around 68 degrees Fahrenheit. That's an acceptable temperature to let this yeast grow up on this agar media. Sometimes, if I see it's kind of taking a little while, I might put it near a warmer spot, like near a radiator, just kind of to raise the temperature just a bit. Yeast will be perfectly happy growing at temperatures around 85 to 90, but then of course, at least in beer, they start to produce those fusel alcohols and so on, so what that we don't like. But given enough days, the yeast will replicate themselves and grow up into nice, thick, white creamy colonies that will be slightly glossy and kind of rounded on top to give you an idea of what they should look like. And after which, you can pop them in the refrigerator. And I know, obviously, it'll differ from strain to strain, but in the lab, we've been able to rescue some yeast that have been on plates in the refrigerator up to a year.
Wow.
So once you've done that step, so you're it's in the fridge now. Now, how do you get it from the fridge to a pitchable amount of yeast?
Well, it would be just the reverse. If you're going to keep it in the refrigerator for an extended period of time, I'd recommend sealing the edges so that the moisture doesn't escape and the yeast don't dry out. Mm-hmm. But you take your plate or your tube of media out with your yeast cells on it. You flame your inoculating loop, sterilize it. You grab a kind of just a big, I would say kind of like a big swath of yeast cells from your plate or tube, mm-hmm. and you put it into a well-aerated small batch of starter liquid that's, again, I'm going to make a reference to BYO magazine. They ran an article on making a starter, and I believe that the original specific gravity should be somewhere around 1035 to 1040.
Yeah,
so that it's not very heavy, but it's there's enough sugar there to get enough yeast cells. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I usually start at about, I'm going to use metric here because I have an Erlenmeyer flask I do in. I usually go straight from 200 milliliters into a 1 or 2 quart starter.
Mm-hmm. So it's important to start small when you start with a small amount of yeast, right?
Yeah, going on the theory that a lot of yeast cells will outcompete other organisms that may have gotten into your brew. Mm-hmm. Conversely, if you don't have enough, then those other organisms might have a chance to take over. So we want to start out small to give the yeast cells a chance to kind of, I guess, cover a smaller ground before stepping them up to a larger ground. And they say always a rule of 10. So when you're switching your starters, your smaller starters into a larger starter, do not make a larger starter larger than 10 times the volume of the one. So if I start out with 200, I would step it up to no more than 2,000, which is 2 quarts, a roundabout.
So yeah, you want your yeast to grow, but you don't want them to be stressed and try to grow too much,
right?
Because they'll be using up the resources that they need later on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is a good strategy for, say, if you're trying to culture a yeast from the dregs of an Orval or something like that, the dregs of an interesting beer. What would be the strategy that you would recommend for someone trying to make a starter and to culture that up into a big enough population to ferment a batch of beer?
What I recommend first is to open the beer, and I read an article on this a couple of days ago, and it was very good advice on how to culture from store-bought bottle-conditioned beer. To have your alcohol lamp at the ready and have it lit, open the beer bottle and stick the mouth of the bottle near the flame. And this serves two purposes. It kills any bacteria that may be lurking around on the lip of the bottle, and it also heats up the air inside that neck, and hot air rises, so it will keep anything from falling in. And then you simply pour your beer, leaving the dregs behind, and then quickly place the cap back on to make sure nothing falls, because bacteria, molds, and contaminants follow gravity. They will fall. If they're in the atmosphere, they will fall down onto your media. Mm-hmm. Cap the bottle back. Take your inoculating loop. stick it over the flame, and then open your bottle back up, flame the lip again, stick your loop in it, and get just a big kind of just kind of stir it around on the bottom for a minute, and then streak it out on your plate and wait a couple of days and see what you get.
Now, is there any way to know if you've done this and you look at your Petri dish and you got obviously two different things going? I mean, how do you know that you have the right thing, the right bug? I mean,
one
I could be
way,
growing, like, huge mess of staph germs, you know? Like, oh, no, what have I done?
Exactly. what you thought was a Belgian wit turned into a nice lambic.
Yeah.
One way of doing it is to do, and I don't quite know the proper term for this, I will call it sort of a reductive streaking method, in which your first streak should be straight from the bottle or your starter, wherever you got your yeast cells from. And then you should make that on a quarter of the plate, and then take your loop and flame it again, and then go on the plate from right where you streaked from and draw one line from the middle, about the middle of your streak, over to another area and streak over there, and to make sure you don't go back into the previously streaked area. And what this does is that you're carrying, each time you do this, you're carrying over only a tiny amount of cells at a time, and eventually you will start to get single yeast colonies, as which I've described before, are thick, fairly opaque, kind of a creamy white, slightly glossy appearance. Mm-hmm. And from then on, I mean, the average homebrewer doesn't have a way to, you know, sequence the DNA to, you know, absolutely make sure, but you can grow it up in a starter. And And that's, I guess that's one of the advantages we have over, immediate advantage we have over the researchers, is that we can sample, our work on the palate.
Yeah.
Just take a quick swig of your starter, and if you don't detect any off flavors, then what you have there is yeast. And then to make sure, you probably want to take a similar colony, though, if it's right next to it and maybe streak it out on another plate just to make sure, because when you make your first streak, there will be so many cells there, you'll get what we call lawn. You won't be able to distinguish any singular colonies, and you may have contaminants in there.
This is kind of reinforces what we've said about starters in the past, is that, you know, one reason that you have a starter is to build up the population of yeast, and another reason is to make sure that what you've got is good yeast, rather than just pitching the yeast blindly into your big old batch of beer. If you make a starter beforehand and smell it and taste it, you can make sure that the yeast is healthy and what you've got is a pure culture. So what if we want to store the yeast for an extended period of time? How do we do that?
As I've said, we've been able to rescue yeast strains off of plates left in the refrigerator for over a year, and plates and tubes will do fairly well if they're sealed, so no moisture gets out. Will do fairly well in your refrigerator for at least a couple of months, probably 3 to 6. Something that we use in the lab that I've in these past couple of days kind of tried to see if we could make a similar procedure in the homebrewing world is we will have a plate grown that has all of our yeast grown up on it, and we will take a big basically hunk of yeast and suspend it in a solution of glycerol, which some people may also know by its more common name, glycerin. Mm-hmm. And three things are happening, and then from that, glycerol, we call glycerol stocks, made that way, are able to be frozen. And freezing a yeast drops it to below, obviously, temperatures that they would normally be operating at, and kind of puts them in a hibernation to which then they can be later retrieved and grown up on a plate fresh. I'm actually making a cream ale right now, and I took my stock out of the freezer Monday, and I'm grew it up on a plate. It was done Wednesday. I'm spinning it in a starter right now. Hmm. Normally, what would happen if you were to freeze yeast in say just pure water is yeast have a fairly thick outer membrane, and they're fairly impervious to basically letting anything through that they don't want to get through. But in solution of pure water, osmosis will happen, and the water will move from an area of higher concentration, i.e. outside the cell, to an area of lower concentration, which is inside the cell. And when the water freezes, the water inside the cell will also freeze. It will form crystals, and the cell will literally explode. Mm-hmm. And killing the yeast.
But glycerin doesn't do that.
Right. So when we freeze them in glycerin stocks, three things are happening here. First, yeast have a glycerin as part of their cellular makeup. And when we introduce them into a solution, it's usually 15% by volume. So, or actually, we use 10% by volume. So that would be 1 milliliter of glycerin and 10 milliliters of and then 9 milliliters of water. that mimics the internal concentration of glycerin inside the cell. Also, the glycerin makes the outer membrane of the cell a little bit more pliable and able to withstand the pressures of what freezing water would do. And additionally, when a solution of glycerin and water freezes, it has different, the way that the crystals form, basically, they have different, I guess, physical properties, and they don't cause quite the what you'd think of like a snowflake looks like. So it's all these things are coming together to ensure that the yeast stays healthy and viable, but is essentially an extended hibernation. Now, one of the things that I thought of is that in the lab we use a freezer that comes down to a minus 80 degrees Celsius, which
is very similar to the temperature outside today here in Arkansas.
Oh yeah,
it's a little cold out.
It's probably not quite that here in Missouri, but it's close. I would say the average home brewer probably does not have access to a freezer that cold. I looked on the internet for a couple of examples. A 5 cubic foot freezer able to go down to a temperature of minus 8 degrees Celsius starts at, and this is one quote I had, so take it with a grain of salt, but started at $6,000.
Wow.
So
is there any way that that home freezers can accomplish freezing yeast in this condition for a long time?
Well, home freezers will freeze the yeast, but researchers caution that any temperature there's no researchers out there cautioning us homebrewers. caution that any temperatures above 55 degrees Celsius cause the cells to start to lose their viability, which means that they basically won't. There will be less and less cells alive. So, to get around this, the home brewer can still make up the glycerin stocks, but I would recommend taking them out, growing them on a fresh plate, and then making a new glycerin stock to put in the freezer. And for a yeast strain that a brewer uses frequently, it may just be more economical to keep it constantly growing on a series of plates or tubes.
So the long-term freezing may not be the best way to go for the home brewer. I mean, we also have to think about the fact that if it's a frost-free refrigerator, it goes in cycles. So it will raise the temperature up and then lower it down to keep the frost out of the freezer. So it's not a constant freezing temperature.
Exactly, exactly. And the problem with that is that it's the same problem as has been alluded to before on I know one of your previous shows about the hop shortage, is that constant cycling of temperatures is not good for the hops. Well, it's not good for the yeast. It's not good for the yeast either. Mm-hmm. When those it's been estimated that every thaw and freeze cycle of yeast cells in a glycerin stock like this corresponds to a 50% reduction in alive cells.
Oh wow! Hmm.
So we need to keep we need to be making sure that once we make a glycerin stock that it stays frozen. And I haven't tested this yet, but perhaps a similar method of storing them in a cooler filled with ice will help buffer them against that temperature change of a frost-free freezer.
Mm-hmm. So putting a cooler in the freezer and putting the some ice on top of the yeast sample would, you know, kind of protect it from that cycle of going warmer and colder and warmer and colder.
Exactly.
So when do you know when to give up on your yeast culture? When do you know when you've had it too long?
Well, if we're talking about storage times, or if we're talking about just, you know, basically how many rounds of propagation that you've had, yeast as a general rule are fairly resistant to random DNA mutations, and this happens in all organisms. You know, the cell just makes a mistake when it's making its DNA. It would take very, very many mutations to noticeably alter the flavor profile of any one yeast. But basically, again, the freedom that we as homebrewers employ is to be able to taste our product. So if you make a starter with yeast that you've cultured yourself and something just doesn't taste right, better to go out and get a fresh packet of yeast from a trusted source and make a starter from that.
So know when to say when, essentially.
Essentially, yeah. There are a lot of caveats with this culturing thing.
So is this something that you would recommend for just any home brewer, or is this take a level of dedication that would scare away most of us?
I would say it takes a level of dedication, but not necessarily a level of professional expertise. I mean, there are, if you go, I Googled it the other day, just culturing beer yeast. If you go and look up culturing beer yeast, there are several websites which provide information. Basically, all that I've said here have detailed photos of how to do it and whatnot. And I think that it's not so much an issue of dedication if the home brewer finds that it's actually an enjoyable. Hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know how many people would find crouching over several yeast plates enjoyable, but I do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, same thing with home brewing. You know, a lot of people that I know say, you know, that when I describe to them the process of doing home brew, they say, "Well, that sounds like a lot of trouble. I'll just go down to the store and get a six pack."
Right.
I get that all the time.
So it just depends. I mean, this is an advanced technique. This is an advanced level of homebrewing. If you want to go that far, this is mm-hmm. something that you would enjoy. But
for me, the appeal of this isn't so much in culturing, say, a Y yeast pack that I can get relatively inexpensively, but I'm really intrigued about culturing yeast from Orval or Chimay or something like that. Now, that to me, that really appeals to me, and that's something that I might want to try because there's no other way to get that yeast, and I think it would be a cool thing to be able to do.
Yeah,
that is one of the benefits. I think to date the only yeast that I've cultured from a bottle there was a, I had a little bit of sediment left, and it had not been too long, so I hoped I hadn't waited too long, but from a bottom of the of a bottle of Blue Moon.
Ah.
And I have that one in a glycerin stock right now, and it's I made a Belgian wit from one time, and it tasted fine. So yeah, that is would be an interesting thing to do from your favorite beers there, especially their bottle conditioned, or I should say only if they're bottle conditioned.
Right. Yeah, if they're filtered, you're out of luck.
Yeah.
But of course, we also have to say that there are some breweries that use a different yeast to bottle condition their beer than they do to do the primary fermentation. So, you know, you may be harvesting a yeast that won't give you the same results that you may be looking for. But
yes, yeah, that is a good point. I have read that a lot of breweries will ferment with one yeast and then choose a yeast that's maybe a little more alcohol tolerant or works a little quicker to consume the primes.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that case, yeah, what you are getting is not the original yeast used to brew the beer. It's just the yeast that provided the extra carbonation, and you can have no idea what the flavor profile that will be.
And there may be some proprietary things going on there too. They may be protecting their primary yeast stock from people who might do what we're talking about.
Yes, there's a possibility. Well, I could think. At least I've read that a lot of microbreweries are just, you know, will say, hey, yeah, come on in, we'll show you around, but I'm not so sure.
Well, Anthony, this has been fun. I don't know, you know, Steve and I may get to I think we'd have to work together on this, Steve, if we were to go into this.
It'd be a major undertaking, a major project that our great scientific prowess put us to the test.
If you see any mutant strains out there, it may be because of our tinkering. But we appreciate your time, and we appreciate your expertise.
Oh, I appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, thanks again to Anthony, and thanks to Steve for helping out in the studio. It's yet another thing to put on my learning list for homebrewing, my list of things to do one day. Well, if you have the brewing questions, show suggestions, or what just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. The 2008 Brewers Logbooks are still here, just a handful of them. Check them out on our site and check out the new low-tech lagering and decoction mashing DVD, where you can see Steve do a single-step decoction mash and follow me through a lager fermentation in the middle of summer. Seems like so long ago, where I don't use a dedicated chest freezer. There are also our original DVDs and Basic Brewing Introduction to Extract Home Brewing. We walk you through the extract brewing process from step-by-step from boiling to bottling. And in Basic Brewing Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all-grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort. And we've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online in our new and improved online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. We've also got shirts and hats. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link as well. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are the Pond Owner's Problem Solver, practical and expert advice on designing, stocking, and managing ponds. And the Great Scandinavian Baking Book. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We appreciate your support. That's all until next week. Maybe my nose won't be stopped up next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio. And our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dodson in Austin. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time. So long.